going to be attached to the ISS. This arm reaches out and grabs it. That end effector eventually wore out. It's built by Canada. The Canadian Space Agency handles that. And there's a couple of them on station, and this one was kind of like shot. So they've lubricated it, and they ran into some other problems. It's been up there since the beginning of the space station around the year 2000 or so. So they're going to refurbish it and eventually send it back up as a spare on the International Space Station. So that was going to be a main story, but then during the week they said on the same day, that Friday, they're going to make an announcement. And I want to say they, NASA, the administrator of Bridenstine was the MC for this, and they made an announcement of the first 9 astronauts that are going to be using the 2 commercial spacecraft, which will be going up as early as next year. And they're going to launch on 2 different spacecraft, the Dragon crew vehicle, or they call it the Crew Dragon, by SpaceX, and they're going to also be launching on the Starliner by Boeing. Both vehicles are capable of carrying up to 4 people, more if they really wanted to, but it's designed for 4 people to travel to the International Space Station. And the idea of this is to replace the $70 million per seat we're paying for our astronauts to fly on the Soyuz spacecraft up to the space station. And that's been going on year after year since 2011. In July, when Atlantis was the final flight to the space station on STS-135. Nevertheless, they named these 9 astronauts, 4 of which I was pretty sure were going to be picked, because about 3 or 4 years ago, NASA has lent them out on a permanent basis to Boeing. Boeing is the company that's building the Starliner spacecraft, and also to SpaceX. They're the ones building the crew version of the Dragon. They need the input from real NASA astronauts, as this thing was, these 2 spacecraft were being developed. So those 4, sure enough, are 4 of the 9 that they picked. So they plan on sending, well, this list anyway is for the first 4 flights. There's going to be a test flight of both Boeing and a test, for the Starliner, and then there's going to be a test flight for Dragon. And then after that, you're going to have a regular flight. They'll start with the regular flights, and then this list of 9 people is going to be those 4 flights. The first flight, most likely to go up, will be a Dragon. Dragon has Douglas Hurley and Robert Behnken. Both have flown before a couple of times, and they'll be on the Dragon crew vehicle early next year. And then the next flight after that, the way it works out on the manifest, is going to be the Boeing Starliner flight. And that's also going to be a test flight. But instead of sending 2 people up, NASA wants to send 3 people up on the test flight. So Starliner will have 3 people. And they'll have Eric Bow, and who's also been up before, and Christopher Ferguson. Christopher Ferguson, he flew the last flight. He flew that Atlantis flight in July of 2011. And sure enough, he's going to be the one to bring up the Starliner to the space station. He'll be the commander. Officially, Christopher Ferguson doesn't work as an astronaut for NASA anymore. He's actually full-time with Boeing. But the other 2, Eric Bow, is an astronaut, and also the third person, Nicole Mann. She's a is also going to be going up on her first flight. She comes out of a Marine. She's I believe it was the Navy. Test pilot. Flew like 25 different test vehicles as a test pilot. So they're going to have these three people go up to the International Space Station and probably stay there for months on end before they dock and bring that craft back. So that will take care of the second flight. So like I said, there will be a test flight for Boeing and then also a test flight for Dragon. The other two flights that they named will be also a Dragon regular mission, and that will be Michael Hopkins, who's flown before, and Victor Glover, which has not flown before. So they'll be the, you know, after the test program, they'll be the first regular flight, and eventually after that, you'll start to see maybe three or four people going up at a time. On the Starliner side for Boeing, after their test flight of three people, the actual regular mission is only going to consist of two people. One, Josh Cossiter, that will be his first flight. And he'll be going up with Tony Williams. She's probably one of the most experienced astronauts there are. Seven spacewalks up to the International Space Station a couple of times. And at one point she was a commander on the space station. And so these nine people will be flying to the International Space Station starting next year. Now, as far as SpaceX and Boeing are concerned with the crew version, they will be testing, each company will test their spacecraft without a crew. And that might come as early as the very end of this year, most likely the beginning of next year. And it's called Demo 1. Demo 1 will be for SpaceX with their Dragon. An orbital flight test vehicle will be the Boeing Starliner. Now, these two missions, NASA really wasn't requiring these two unmanned missions. But both companies, SpaceX and Boeing, said that they really would like to have this. So they're going to launch an unmanned vehicle, both of them, to the space station. They'll dock autonomously to the ISS, stay there for, I think, a week or two, and then actually bring some supplies up. You know, they're not going to waste a flight. They'll bring some supplies up, and then it will dock autonomously, and SpaceX Dragon will come back and land in the Pacific Ocean, similar to what they do with their cargo vehicles. And Boeing, they have no plans of landing in the water. They plan on landing, I think, not too far from John over in Los Alamos, KC-2 SHO. I think their first landing, they would probably like to do in White Sands, New Mexico. I know it's not around the block from Los Alamos, but they're thinking about that location. There's also a couple of other locations that they could go to. That will come out of the sky with a heat shield, and eventually the heat shield actually separates from the spacecraft and leaves these big airbags. So it comes out of space, the heat shield, parachutes, and gets close to the ground. The heat shield goes away, and these big airbags pop open at the very last second to cushion the fall. So hopefully they'll get this going. I know both companies have a lot of work to do. For instance, Boeing just ran a test on their LAS system, the launch abort system for Starliner. And they light off four engines, and this was done in a test bed. They light off four engines and see how it goes. each one produces 40,000 pounds of thrust. And when they shut off on this one test, some of the valves did not close and actually wound up leaking. So they can't have that. They believe they have the problem figured out, but it's going to take a little extra time. So that's why I think SpaceX will probably launch first the way it's going, unless they develop a problem. So this will be good. They'll be launching, of course, from Florida. SpaceX will launch from Launch Complex 39A, and that's the same one of the same complexes that the shuttles used to launch from, as well as the Saturn V rockets. Everything's been redone for SpaceX. Actually, SpaceX paid for all the refurbishment of this Launch Complex 39A. And then 39B is still being used by NASA. That will be used for the Space Launch System. Let me drop it. The other one is Starliner. That will be launching from Launch Complex 41. 41 is the one they're using. And that will launch on an Atlas V rocket. And they call it a 422 configuration. That means the equivalent diameter of this spacecraft is roughly 4 meters. So that's where the first four comes in. And then 422, the second two has to do with the solid booster rockets that will be attached to the Atlas V. Two solids will be attached. Now, Boeing has done this type of thing many, many times, so they're very confident that they won't have a problem. And then the last two will, it's a designation for the upper Centaur, they call it 10L rocket. It's liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket that's built by Rocketdyne, Aerojet Rocketdyne. And instead of having one, they're going to have two. And that's what they're going to use for their second stage. On this particular flight, on all their flights. So before I move on, is there any questions about manned space flight, which is coming around? It's been a long time since 2011, but hopefully this will become a reality next year, and we can stop paying $70 million per person to go up on the up to the International Space Station. You know, a couple of times a year, you know, for Russians. There might be some kind of delays for regular crews, four people at a time. And if that happens, NASA will probably get a couple of more seats from the Russians on the Soyuz, but they won't have to pay for it because they're going to make a deal with the Russians. If you let us ride free for these couple of flights, if we need it, you know, we'll take you on our spaceship. So that's it. Any comments on this topic before I move on? This is WS2N. Okay, very good. A couple of other things to talk about. We have a couple of flights coming up that I'm anxious to see. I know I've talked about it before. Parker Solar Probe will be going up on the 11th of August. So, that's the one that's eventually going to be going to the sun, to the corona, 3.7 million miles away from the surface of the sun. So, we'll look forward to that launch coming up August 11th. From what I heard, that's all go. And that actually made it onto CBS News. I heard that the other day. So, that's pretty good. Let me drop it. And then after that, you have a launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base. There's other launches, you know, there's some by European Space Agency, some by China. But I really concern myself with the ones that are a little different and a little bit unusual, such as this one launching out of Vandenberg, California, on a Falcon 9 Block 5, one of their new boosters. They're going to be sending a satellite up to, you know, to polar orbit. But the interesting thing about this flight, it'll be the first time that SpaceX brings their booster back to land in California. They've done this many times in Florida. You know, they'll launch a satellite to space, and you'll see this 15-story booster come back and land right back in California, about 2.5 miles away from where it took off. But this flight, coming up in September, actually, is probably mid-September, from Vandenberg, California. When they launch the satellite to polar orbit, the booster is going to come back, and they have a big round landing area, and it's only 1,400 feet. Not like two and a half miles away, like down in Florida. It's only about 1,400 feet away from where it launched, where it will be launched from. And they have a big X point, you know, on this big concrete pad. And that's where this thing is going to come back and land, hopefully dead center. So that's another step to keeping the course down of space travel. Yeah, they've done it many times where they launched and landed on an autonomous ship and then bring the ship back. But, you know, that costs money. So you make it cheaper, they try to bring the booster directly back to land. And it's the first time they got an approval, actually, from the FAA to do this. You know, it's been delayed, but they finally got around to it. One other topic I want to talk about is the Stirling engine. So let me pause, see if anybody has any questions or comments about anything we've covered so far. Okay, very good. The Stirling engine that's being developed by NASA. They have this thing running for, you know, years on end, not days, but years on end. It's been operating since 2003 in Ohio. They have the NASA's Glenn Research Center there. And they added up the hours. It's been going for 110,000 consecutive hours all the way from 2003. It's a Stirling engine, and all you do is apply heat to it, and it has this piston that goes up and down, and they make electricity out of this. And the idea is to eventually create some kind of a generator that you can put on a spaceship that could last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years and go on these long duration missions producing electricity. They'd like to do it, you know, to create more electricity than what they usually create, which is, you know, maybe 100 or 200 watts of power from these RTGs. RTGs are the radioisotope thermoelectric generators, which they've been using, you know, since the beginning of the space program, practically. There's been like 30 or more launches with RTGs on it. But they'd like to get, you know, four or five or maybe six times more power out of the same isotope. They use uranium-238, and the heat from that is wrapped in these thermal blankets, and the thermal blankets heat up these thermocouples, and the thermocouples are, you know, two different metals, dissimilar metals that are attached together, and when you heat, you know, apply heat, you get electricity, and they have, you know, hundreds of these things parallel in series, and eventually that's how they develop their 28 volts and power for spacecraft. And this has been going on for decades. What they would like to do is get a lot more power out of the same uranium-238. Uranium-238 gives off a lot of heat. If you remember the movie The Martian, you know, The Martian, he he eventually went out to get the plutonium from one of the earlier missions, and he used that to keep himself warm. Well, that's what you could do with plutonium-238, the heat that's creating the electricity in the in these thermocouples. There's actually a lot more heat, four or five, maybe six times more heat that is actually coming off and it's being wasted. This wasted heat, NASA presently uses, they have tubes, you know, piping that come from that area, and it keeps the rest of the electronics warm and all the moving parts. They are able to heat the spacecraft. Well, they want to be able to create more electricity. Instead of having the thermocouples, they're going to take the heat from the plutonium-238, and then they're going to pipe that to the Stirling engine, which they've been working on, which has been going nonstop, never changed a part. It just keeps going all by itself since 2003. And the way that makes electricity, and the reason it doesn't need any new parts, this piston keeps grinding up and down. And attached to the piston is this magnet, and the magnet keeps going up and down. And they have a coil around it, so it's a magnetic field. And it's essentially a linear alternator, and that's how they make the electricity. And they think they can get four, five, six times more more power out of that, just using the heat from the plutonium-238 instead of just taking the heat and heating up thermocouples. So that's the future of space travel for robotic spacecraft, but they could also use it for the moon. They plan on eventually sending these things to the moon, and because the moon goes into darkness for 2 weeks, 14 days, and daylight for 14 days, those 14 days at night, needless to say, very cold, a couple hundred, 200, maybe 250 degrees below zero. This power source, this uranium-238, they could use that heat to make electricity using the Stirling engine. They could also use some of the excess heat to keep their building warm, whatever habitat they build. And, you know, this is only one type of system that they're going to use. They actually just use the heat from the plutonium. They're working on another thing called Crusty, which will also use Stirling engines, but the difference is they plan on using, instead of uranium-238, they want to use uranium-235, and that's a fissionable material. They could actually create a fission system with that, and they have. And they've run that test over where John is, KC2SHO, in Los Alamos. So they've run tests with this thing using plutonium-235 as a fissionable material. And they've run the Stirling engine, and they've gotten 10 kilowatts out of this thing. You know, that's a lot of kilowatts. Your standard generator in your house is sometimes 4 or maybe 8 kilowatts. This thing's putting out 10 kilowatts. Let me drop it. They think with 4 of these, fissionable material, 235, attached to Stirling engines, if you took like 4 of these, you could definitely make a habitat and plenty of power to have a little base on the moon. They'll be able to survive no problem in darkness. That's what they think. So that's under development. I thought I'd bring that up. It's an amazing machine that's been running all these years. And there's a couple of other machines that they also put online. But this one is running the longest. There's a couple of other ones behind it. So it's amazing. You don't need any oil. You don't need to worry about filling the walls. It's quite a contraption. And very few moving parts. Any comments or questions for this part of the net? This is WS2M.
Yes, Paul.
Yes, go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, it's plutonium-238 that's used in RTGs, according to my understanding. Plutonium-239 will decay into uranium-235, which is what they're kind of playing with on the side. I don't think that there's an active plutonium-235 that's stable enough to be used for anything. So it's plutonium-238 in the RTG and uranium-235 in the very experimental stuff. I would love to learn the efficiencies of the Stirling versus the thermocouple.
Yeah, they're claiming it's 4 to 6 times more efficient. You get a lot more heat out of, I think it's something like 1,300 watts of equivalent. If you took the heat that comes off the 238, you can actually heat up a room with that. If you take that same heat and heat up thermocouples, you might have. I think it's a 1 to 6 ratio. I'll have to find that paper, but it's at least 4 times better, more efficient. And it's cool. What they have is this unit that's actually running, not the one that's been running since 2003. This other one that's running 10 kilowatts. It's called Krusty, KRUSTY. It's the kilopower reactor using Stirling technology. So that's the acronym. It's called Krusty, kilowatt reactor using Stirling technology. And that's the one I think that's the one that was in New Mexico. They also had one in Glen. I think that was also in Glen Research Center in Ohio. And they use 230. This one here is 235 because they're creating fission with it, actual fission. The other one for RTGs is 238.
Repeater, timeout.
It's not ready for flight yet, that's for sure. But they definitely need something like this. And then when you say fission, everybody panics. We actually had something called SNAP-10. That was a spacecraft that launched in the 1960s. And it flew to 100 miles in altitude and went into orbit, polar orbit. And it stayed there for... regulator on it. System itself, but they were running a fission power plant. We were NASA. Roscosmos, well, it wasn't called Roscosmos back there, but
the Soviet Union has launched about 30 of these fissionable things into space. So it's doable. It's been done before. And once it leaves orbit here, they send it to the moon, we won't have to think about it coming back into the atmosphere. Any comments or questions? Okay. Only one other thing is that having to do with the crews that has been chosen for Boeing and for SpaceX. They're presently testing. So some nice pictures of them using the escape system. The escape system as if they were in the white room getting dressed, getting ready to board the spacecraft. And let's say they had boarded the spacecraft and they said, there's an emergency here. We need to have you leave the launch complex. They go over to these zip lines and they attach themselves to these zip lines. Not like the old days where there was a cage. I mean, they physically connect they're in a spacesuit. They connect to the zip line. 170 foot roughly height. It's like the equivalent of a 17-story building, and they go flying down the zip line and all the way to where it actually lands, and there's these big arrows, when they actually land, and with their feet, and then they disconnect and they follow these big yellow arrows into these bomb-proof vehicles, and pretty incredible what they have to do to hook themselves up to this thing. If you see the pictures, you can see the launch complex, where they would be launching from, and you can see where they're going to wind up, how far away from the launch complex they're actually going to land, and you see these two little dots, and that's the two astronauts, zipping along on the zip line, and it must be pretty terrifying if you're not an astronaut. I mean, these people are used to this type of thing, but I don't think you're going to see this ride open up anytime soon in Disneyland. But wow, quite a deal to be hanging from this thing. Any comments or questions?
Yes. I'd like to ask a question about the Stirling engine. The thermocouples non-moving parts. The Stirling engine is moving parts. Have they stated anything about the life of those moving parts on the Stirling engine type of RTG? Hope you pull K2RW. As you said, they're running one since 2000, so it's been running mechanically for all of those years. Give me some more words on that, Paul. K2RW.
Yes, that's correct. It hasn't stopped. No replacement parts. This piston that rides up and down in the cylinder has some kind of spiral, material attached to it. And no air pressure passes it, but the piston keeps riding up and down, and this spring-like spiral thing keeps going up and down with it. They couldn't do it in the 70s or 80s. They didn't have the material. The materials have come so far, material science, that they're able to use this stuff, and they said there's a lot of different material sciences stuff that they could use. So it's actually become no problem, according to what I was reading. So they don't have to worry about the walls even being touched by the piston. The piston itself has this magnet on it, and that's riding up and down with this coil on the outside. And so you know how that works. That's by that moving back and forth, you're generating current back to you there.
As recognized, but it's still got a crankshaft, and that crankshaft you would think has some lubrication requirements and wear. Let's Eric first. K2EJ, go ahead, Eric.
No crankshaft, it's not spinning.
Yeah, what I was going to say is, and from what I understand, you're looking at a single piston, that's in a cylinder, in fact, it's horizontally mounted. It has a very strong manipulative magnet on it. The casing is non-magnetic. It has some interesting channels that they've actually experimented with in terms of moving the fluid. The best fluid, of course, is hydrogen, but I believe they use helium. And the piston itself, or really it's like a bullet that fits in there between the cold and hot chamber, and there's actually no valve. It covers the port by its motion, and it, in essence, doesn't really touch the cylinder wall, so that's why they've got it running for so many years, and they've even improved the design over the years. Back to you, Paul.
Boy, that sounds very crafty. Thank you, Eric. Go ahead, Paul.
He described that better than I could, but he's describing exactly what I was looking at when I saw the design and what I read about it. So that's a very good description of what we're talking about. Yeah, there's no moving parts. Now, they are working on some kind of a continuous flow type of system. I was trying to think of the name of that. But there is a, begins with a B. But they plan on doing another type of motor that will keep going as well. Sort of like a jet engine, you know, where you apply constant heat to it, and this thing will constantly rotate, and they think that will be good too. But right now they're very happy with this. With this Stirling engine that they built. Apparently, they've got a couple of other designs on the drawing board as well. Back to you, Dick.
I thank you, Paul. You've explained that very well. In the case of a turbine, I can see how you could apply a very high temperature to the center of a jet engine-like structure, where instead of having the burning modules, you have something that gives off heat. But still, that's a lot of rotary motion and bearings and seals. Whereas this Stirling engine-like thing, boy, that sounds like a beauty. Back to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's not a lot big. You know, I mean, they show the guy standing next to it. It's probably about, I don't know, 5 feet tall, I guess. The thing I was trying to think of is it's a Brayton. They call it a Brayton rotary cycle. That's different. Brayton is an old-time guy from like the 1800s that developed the, I guess the, you want to call it the beginning of the jet engine type of thing. But NASA is currently developing a different iteration. It's of the free piston Stirling converter. But, you know, they've got this other thing in mind. It's a gas bearing converter, and using a baryton rotating cycle. Baryton, I mean, that's B-R-A-Y-T-O-N. He's the guy that invented this like 100 years ago or more.
I presume all of these Stirling engine like things I can find on the NASA site. Eric first, and then when it comes back to you, Paul, tell me where I can find this. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, if you should happen to be in Las Vegas, and you go by UNLV, which is the University of Las Vegas, you'll see they have a movable mirror assembly. It's a solar collector. And right at the focal point is mounted a Stirling engine that produces 35 or 36 kilowatts, I forget the size. It's not that big, but there's an actual real working Stirling engine there, and it's been there for like 15 or 20 years at this point. You know, the Stirling engine is a rather old principle and old technology, and, you know, with today's modern materials, it's become quite an interesting device.
Eric, is that the one with all these mirrors that you got, like, hundreds of mirrors, big mirrors, pointing at this one focal point?
Yeah, it's actually a collection of mirrors at multiple layers that actually focus on the back of this engine. This is actually a commercial engine made by Stirling. They sell them that you can actually stick them in the the exhaust of your boiler or any heat source, and it will operate.
Okay. I know they have this massive thing. It must cover half a dozen acres. And it's pointing at this one thing. I think that was the stirring engine, too. I think they had helium in that thing as well. Okay, very good. And, Dick, I'll have to put some of these articles together. You know, I have it on my my list, you know, on the computer. I'll send it to you. Because, you know, it's an aggregation of a lot of different websites that I put together. So I'll send you a picture of what this thing looks like anyway.
Thank you, Paul.
Very good. And you know, it's really two stories in one. There's the one that's going to just use the heat from the plutonium-238, and then there's this other one that's going to create 10 kilowatts of power using, that already is, they've tested it, using uranium-235, and they did all sorts of stuff. They tried to, duplicated this thing breaking. They broke all the heat tubes and all this other stuff, one thing after the other, and the thing just kept on running. They said they really beat this machine up. They wanted to see how good it was going to run. So they only ran that for a couple of days. That's a different one. That's different than the one that's been running from 2003. So it's like two stories in one, and I probably confused everybody by doing that. Any other comments for the net? Well, you know, we've always talked about how are they going to try to, you know, get electricity and heat to the astronauts, you know, when they go through into darkness. And this is one of the plans, you know, to sit down just on the South Pole where most of the time the sun is always there, and just run solar panels and think that that's going to be good enough. That's not going to work. You're going to need some kind of uranium power one way or another, and innovations like the stirring engine to be able to create a base, essentially a base on the moon. You know, yeah, they could go to these lava tubes and all this, but that's not good enough. Any other comments? Dick, I didn't have anything else, and still have a few minutes left, so I don't know if Roy wants to add anything, anything that he left out, but that's it for me for this part of the SpaceNet report. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Let's see if Roy, if he wanted to, could go through one more of his items. AC2GS, K2RAW, go ahead, Roy.
Okie doke, and I also will have some links to the Krusty power reactor generator on my link site. Anyway, getting to this. Talking about, the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation is holding a series of hearings leading up to another NASA authorization bill, which helps set goals and authorizes funding for the agency. On last Wednesday, scientists from the U.S. universities, the Smithsonian Institution, and NASA answered senators' questions about why Congress should fund the hunt for extraterrestrial life. Let me drop. I believe it's one of the big questions of all humanity, Thomas Zurbriggen, NASA's Associate Administrator for the Science Mission Directorate, told Senate Committee. This is how great nations make a mark, what they do for their citizens and how they move history forward. Some of the researchers noted that pursuing tough questions brings innovation and drives the economy forward. Practical technologies such as GPS came from scientists solving physics problems they were interested in. Also, satellites, nukes, and Cold War. The search for alien life also draws new excitement, encouraging young researchers to enter the field. Most senior engineers today, either in civilian space science, national defense, or national security, were inspired by the moon landing, Sarah Sager, MIT professor of physics and planetary science, told the committee. And today, the equivalent of that is the search for life. Let me drop. One common theme was something that tends to resonate with members of Congress, America being the best of all this technical stuff. While the U.S. can still be considered a leader in space science, We're still developing impressive technology like the Starshade that could assist in the Earth 2.0 hunt. European and Chinese space programs are catching up in terms of research, development, and innovation. Looking to where China might be a decade from now, if we stop investing, they will be the leaders, Princeton astronomer David Spergel told the senators. Let me drop. Senator Ed Markey asked about climate change and how space exploration could help people here on Earth. Ellen Stofan, director of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, explained that looking at climates of other planets has helped us understand our own. Specifically, studying Venus's atmosphere helped scientists identify the hole in Earth's ozone layer back in the 1970s. Sager mentioned that medical imaging relies on astronomy techniques and that her team at MIT is working on a small planet-hunting satellite that will probably be more useful for the way it packages data than the way it finds exoplanets. There's so many we could talk about for hours, said Zerbuk. Let me drop. Senator Gary Peters asked why physicists think that life might be on Mars, given that it only had water for around 500 million years. Stofan explained the importance of actually sending humans to Mars. The life that might have developed on the planet wouldn't have been complex, but single-celled. I think it will take humans on the planet breaking open a lot of rocks to find fossilized evidence of life, she said. Senator Peters asked whether there might be advanced civilizations we weren't able to find. Stofan said that NASA is pursuing the correct way of locating life, which is first understanding the nature and variety of life that may have evolved in our own solar system. This knowledge could provide a basis for finding complex life elsewhere in the galaxy. Let me drop. It's clear that both houses of Congress are excited about space science, despite recent setbacks related to the James Webb Space Satellite Telescope. They don't want to lose ground to China, and they want new technologies that private industry can use. But most importantly, pretty much everyone wants to find aliens. So, nanu nanu to the Senate.
Let me ask Paul on this one. Isn't James Webb going to have the ability to have enough resolution to see exoplanets, and as they pass in front of the local sun, by looking at the signature of the elements viewed by the solar light going through the atmosphere, I think they can predict whether or not hydrocarbons have been generated and whether or not a lot of possible life forms exist on that planet. Isn't that one of the claims that James Webb is possibly going to be able to do? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to be able to see the planet, but they have this spectrograph on board, which I've read that they believe they're going to be able to tell if there's methane in a planet's atmosphere or oxygen, and they're going to target those planets using TESS. TESS is the one that's up there now, looking at the close nearby stars, and that will identify all these different planets. They think thousands of them, and they'll turn that information over to the operators of James Webb, and then, you know, with that thing, they'll be able to look at those planets and look for oxygen and methane, what it's made of. As far as visually seeing it, I don't think so. I think some of the ground-based telescopes will be able to do that. In fact, I think one already has a very large telescope in Chile has done that already, but expect better pictures in the future. But I don't think so from James Webb.
Yeah, I've read about the Chile finding it. Back to you for some final comments, Paul, and Roy. We're almost running out of time. You got it, Roy.
Okay, well, that was the sum total. The way to sell Congress is to talk about either little green men or a technological gap that we're having with, these days it's China more than Russia. But it worked in the old days. Hopefully it'll work in the future.
I thank you, Roy. Thank you, Paul. That was TechNet number 1710. That was Space Report number 180. That was Science Talk number 40. 73, you all. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW and the crew, Berkeley.